Hey, here we are again, Old School Guns, the podcast that gives you information, critiques of the gun media, critiques of gun news and opinion, and also some questions that we hope you find interesting and want to know the answer to. First thing we'll get into is, what in the world is going on at the NRA? Every time I think this is kind of closed and we're going to head back to normalcy, something else pops up. What the latest is, Alan West is bringing up the issues from the last NRA annual meetings, this whole thing of expenses, and now there's an intern whose rent was paid, and a few other things. And frankly, I like Alan West. I mean, I think he's one of the guys who I'm hoping can straighten this out. And I hope Willis Lee, the new second vice president, joins with him. I think those are the guys who can straighten this out, get to the bottom of whatever is happening, and definitely correct the situation. I'm really unhappy when I see things like, you know, $200,000 in suits, and I don't know. These are just numbers that are getting off the media, which is unfriendly to the NRA. So whether or not it is how accurate these numbers are, I do not know. But it seems that they're immense, and it doesn't matter to me if it's $100,000 or $200,000. It seems to be very, very excessive. And that needs to stop, because you need to stop asking me to send you $25, $50, $100, $200, whatever it is, so that somebody can have the very best silk ties and all the other little goodies that go on with being this corporate celebrity culture we seem to have. I have no problem with a clothing allowance. I just think that it has to be something more in line with what the members would expect. And I think that's what's caught everybody by surprise, is, you know, how immense these things are. Apparently, there was a lawyer bill for $24 million. Somebody basically, what they were doing was they billed the NRA for $24 million, and it worked out to like $97,000 a day. That's BS. That is BS, and that needs to stop. That is just hemorrhaging cash. Again, cash that we're collecting in the 25 to 50 to whatever dollar amounts. I mean, and not to mention the NRA estate planning, where they kind of say, hey, if you don't have anybody to leave your stuff to, you can always leave all or part of it to us. They have to start being better stewards with the money. There's just no two ways about it, and we're not going to tolerate this kind of malfeasance going on. And apparently it's been going on for a while, and you know, I understand it's a big organization. Big organizations work in a big way. I know that Wayne LaPierre really can't travel on civilian airlines, and a lot of times you can't throw him back into coach. Some anti will recognize him and beat him up, or there'll be a confrontation, or there'll be some sort of, you know, some really bad incident. A lot of people have to travel by charter just because of who they are and what they represent, and he's probably one of them. We don't want anything bad to happen. We don't want the negative publicity of him telling someone to go off, because it always gets cut to make their agenda, and it would always make the NRA look bad. So I kind of get some of this, and if they can justify some of it, I get it. If it's $200,000 over 15 years, I kind of get that. I mean, I kind of get that, I suppose. It still seems excessive, but you know, they need to come clean with what this is. They need a transparent system by which this stuff is appropriated for and accounted for. And I think that's one of the first things that just has to be done. Restore the members' faith. And if there's been wrongdoing, let's get it out there, get it corrected, and take whatever remedial action. And if somebody has to resign over it, well, so be it. Some of the people who should probably resign over it are people on the NRA board, that mysterious organization. You know, I think even just to run for the board, you have to get 250 members' signatures, and they got to be verified. And then they basically put you on the ballot, and they send out, by their own admission, I think a couple of million ballots a year. And I think they get back between 150 and 200,000. So it's really a smaller percentage of the NRA membership actually votes and elects these people. And there's people on there that have been there forever. I mean, Marion Hammer has been on there forever, and she's 80 years old, and she also works as an NRA lobbyist. How effective she is, I don't know. She's 80 years old. I mean, I would think that at that age, you'd be slowing down a bit and not necessarily be the best representative of the organization. That's just what I think. I think some of the other people who are on there too. Larry Craig, that individual who was in the Senate and got arrested for lewd behavior at an airport and pleaded guilty initially, then tried to draw it back. I'm sorry, I don't need Larry Craig on the board. I don't know who he's connected to, what pull he has, or whatever it is. He can go back to the airport and act in a lewd manner, and that's between him and the law. I don't want him on the NRA board. I just don't. I didn't vote for the guy, and I would never vote for him. It's funny, I looked at the ballot and said, oh, this can't be the same guy. This can't be the same guy. And lo and behold, it was. And he's been reelected. I'd like to see the vote totals. I'd like to know their procedure for counting the votes. What are the parameters for throwing a vote out as opposed to counting it? All of that kind of stuff. I really want to know all this because guess what? We all have a stake in the organization. It's not a personal empire that belongs to anyone. It belongs to all of us as members, from the annual member up to the patron and benefactor and big money members. It all belongs to us, and we should demand accountability. So that being said, I think there's some other things in the news. Definitely the Democrats are making the usual terrible and actually amusingly imbecilic threats. Kamala Harris, no more AR-15s will be imported. Well, she's evidently so stupid, she doesn't even know that the AR-15s are made here. We don't import any of them. We don't. I can't think of a single imported AR-15. There might be some AR-15 style shotguns, a different animal altogether, legally and under the law, under the ATF, everything else. A shotgun is completely different. It's not a rifle. It's not a semi-automatic rifle. It isn't even what they would call an assault rifle, incorrectly call an assault rifle. But it's a shotgun. So there may be a few of those that are made overseas, but their AR-15 is not imported. Maybe this was some talking point she got with Pillow Talk from Willie Brown or one of her other mentors who she was extremely close to. But this is a person who she doesn't think, she had very questionable conduct and behavior, and really she's not even really senator material, much less presidential material. Just a real disgrace, part of the identity politics circus that our Congress has become. You know, the Talibs, the Ocasio-Cortezes, the Omars, you know, saying vicious, ugly things, anti-Semitic things, all kinds of stuff. Just, you know, really doesn't. And you know, they're not the only fools in Congress. Congress is unfortunately replete with fools. One of the biggest fools being Mitt, the establishment lackey Romney. People of Utah, what a mistake electing that guy. A tremendous mistake. He's not even really from there. He's, you know, a governor of Massachusetts and lived in Minnesota and all these, or Michigan, I'm sorry, Michigan, not Minnesota. So, you know, he's a transplant. He's just like electing, he's the right's version of Hillary Clinton. You know, she just kind of buys a house in New York and she gets a Senate seat. I guess he buys a house in Utah and gets a Senate seat. We need to think about this. We need to think about this long and hard before we vote, before we support somebody just out of hand. You know, I just was reminded today that I'm pretty independent. I would support a pro-gun Democrat if one existed and if they were trustworthy. A lot of them basically will say they're pro-gun, but they're not. They're not pro-hunting, not pro-gun, not pro-anything, and throw us under the bus. Republicans, though, have done a really good job throwing us under the bus. And even guys who I kind of admire some aspects of their lives, like Bob Dole's service record. 94 assault weapon ban was basically facilitated by Bob Dole. He could have blocked it from coming up for a vote. He chose not to do that, knowing it would pass. Even though he knew he was going to vote against it, he knew it was going to pass. So right away, they basically did us right there. Ford, Reagan, and no surprise, Carter, all signed a letter basically in support of the 94 assault weapons ban. So think about that. Think about George H.W. Bush. Think about his import bans. And I talked about those on another podcast. They've been no friends of ours. They've been no friends. The NFA has closed for Class 3 fully automatic weapons since 1986. And that's because of Republicans, too. Democrats wanted that, but Republicans basically made it through. So it's been 32 years now. And prices for those things are out of the, you know, they're just really out of the ballpark. So, you know, it's never going to be back to normal unless we can open that up again. And there should be ways to do that. There should also be a priority list for the NRA. Like, let's get rid of Section 922R, that stupid thing that came in with the Bush import things. Let's make it go away. You want to help gun owners right now, and Donald Trump could do this. Let's take short-barreled rifles out of the NFA. Hey, you buy a 1927 semi-automatic Thompson rifle. Guess what? You can put a 10-inch barrel on it without legal problems. Or you can buy it from Car Arms that way and buy it just like any other gun. That would be a good thing. And that would also, you know, stretch obviously to the all the other short-barreled rifles also. There's already a bunch of exempt weapons. Your artillery Lugers, Browning High Powers, Mauser C96s, they're all exempt from that. The rest of these could be exempt also. You won't see it. There simply will not be a wave of crime because of this. Should work on getting sound suppressors off the NFA also. A lot of people, it would help their hearing. It would definitely be something that is reasonable, something other countries have already done, and something that we should definitely do. Working about basically a national concealed carry, so that if I can carry concealed in the state of Kansas, I can carry concealed in the state of Washington too, or any of the states in between. Perhaps having some uniform gun laws and not allowing preemption. Maybe the AR-15 bans are stupid, and maybe we shouldn't have different states with different laws, so that if I own an AR-15, right now I can't move to California. Not that I'd ever want to, but I can't, and take that rifle with me. I'd have to sell it, then move there. It's simply not allowed. This is the United States. This is not Nazi Germany. It is not Soviet Russia. We have the right to keep and bear arms, but these preemptive laws basically chip away at that on the periphery. A bolt-action hunting rifle does not serve me the same purpose that my AR-15 does as far as my own safety and security. And I think that all of these laws are based on the ridiculous presumption that criminals will obey them. And they will take a less efficient weapon because there's a law against a more efficient one or a different type of weapon. That simply does not work. And I think we're very close to seeing some guns being imported from Mexico illegally. I think that's going to be the next thing. They'll be smuggling weapons across the border for gangs and cartels. And, you know, this evil is spreading north. And it's not the actual man in the street in Mexico that's doing it. This is organized crime. This is a deliberate subversion. These are criminal gangs. These aren't the normal people. So it's not being anti-Mexican to want to confront these challenges and turn them back and have our own safety and security. Well, that's enough for the 2A. Let's see. We do have some questions, and one of my favorite questions coming up, this is actually related to an earlier podcast, is why didn't the United States adopt the FN-FAL rifle instead of the M14? You know, why did we adopt the M14? Why the FAL was actually a more developed design. The T-44, which became the M14, was kind of just off the drawing board. excuse me. Why did that happen? And there have been books out, there have been innumerable articles. Well, the test is rigged, and the test was phony, and there was the not invented here syndrome, and all these other things. Basically, all that's hogwash. Here's really what it came down to. Here's really the crux of the entire thing. When the Army holds trials, unless they're going to issue a contract at the end, which they have no real obligation to do, they can set up the trials however way they want. There's no laws, there's no governing that they have to be a fair and equal trial. So, you know, to sit here and think that, well, the tests were rigged, the tests were this, that, and the other thing, that's just simply out of the deal. There was no obligation to let a contract for a new rifle anyway. It was simply trials where they're looking at them and seeing how they perform. Here's the reason they chose the M14. It's very simple. Even though Belgium said we could produce the FN-FAL here domestically without paying any royalties or any kind of tax or any kind of gratuity to them, basically that's kind of what they said. That's not really legal in a contract, and, you know, saying something does not necessarily make it true. So I think they were a little bit leery of that, even though that seemed to be a pretty generous offer. The Belgians, of course, knew that if the United States adopted this rifle, it would sell like hotcakes. So they had a bit of a, they weren't completely altruistic in their offer. The Belgians were set up, they did not develop the FAL for the Belgian army and maybe one or two neighbors. They just didn't. They knew it was going to be a worldwide commodity. They knew they were going to market it around the world, as FN had marketed other weapons before the Second World War and after the Second World War. They were an arms manufacturing company, and they want business, and they were going to sell it everywhere. United States, on the other hand, there was no real interest in making FALs here and selling them abroad, which would have violated some sort of agreement that they would have had with FN, I'm sure. The other thing was, we weren't interested in really selling M14 rifles. This was for domestic consumption, our own use. So the United States had a completely different view of what was going to go on. The Belgians were much more business-minded. We were much more, hey, let's get us a rifle that we can make here. The M14 has been described as a product-improved M1 Garand, and frankly, that's exactly what it is. The cartridge is more efficient, the 7.62 NATO cartridge, and we made sure everybody adopted that. We made sure of that. The other thing is, it's got an improved gas system, so you don't have that loose gas cylinder hanging on the end of the barrel where it can get knocked about and the finish rubbed off it and shiny and all the rest. It has a shortened op rod, which is a lot less frail, and it has an improved gas system, which is about a third of the way down the barrel, a traditional gas system. But other than that, it's pretty much a Garand rifle. It's the action is the proven Garand action. The sights are actually even interchangeable with the M1, as are some of the trigger parts. Not all, but some. And the trigger works fundamentally the same way. It locks into the stock the same way. It's very, very many similarities. And it does have a 20-round magazine, which addressed the problem of capacity in the M1, the perceived problem that 8 rounds is not enough, 20 rounds is better. Although I will say that changing out the magazines takes a little bit of time, but you know, if you're really good with an M1, you can maybe not keep up shot for shot, but you can keep up reasonably well. But being that, as it said, box magazine, detachable box magazines were the way to go. the proven grand action. We just fought World War II and the Korean War, and frankly, we were very pleased with the performance of the Garand. Accurate, durable, reliable, robust. It performed exactly as it was intended. It was a first-rate infantry rifle. The only thing wrong with it was, in theory, we were on the verge of a new era, and the M14 did not really fit into that era. The FAL sort of did a little bit, but not really. The intermediate cartridge, detachable magazine assault rifle, as first illustrated by the German MP44, and later the Soviet AK-47 and AK series AKMs and RPKs. You know, that was the weapon. That was the weapon that was showing the way forward, not the traditional battle rifle. As excellent as the M14 is as a battle rifle, and as excellent as the M1 were, the nature of warfare was changing. So, though they really weren't the way ahead, but it made sense at the time. At the time, World War III was actually viewed as winnable in the 1950s. And it was also viewed upon that nuclear weapons would be used, but there was no mutually assured destruction. And the Soviets did not have that many weapons. You know, the NATO and even the mainland United States could have probably absorbed those and still kept fighting. And why would we want a rifle that looked like our World War II rifle? Well, most of our military manpower, which had been trained in World War II in Korea, our reserve military manpower was trained with the Garand rifle. So therefore, it made sense to adopt a rifle that was very similar to the Garand, as opposed to one that is very dissimilar, like the FAL. The FAL works differently. The controls are in a different place. The sights are different. The takedown is different. Everything about it is different, even though it shoots the same cartridge as the M14. The M14, if I'm familiar with an M1, I can convert to the M14 in an hour or two at the most. An hour or two. When you're mobilizing potentially millions of men, that comes out to millions of man hours, as opposed to probably a lot longer, couple days anyway, it would take to transition somebody who's familiar with the M1 and not really a weapons guy, and you put this FNFAL in their hand and it's completely different. You have to give them more time to get familiar with it and train. Plus, our M1 and M2 carbines worked fundamentally the same way as the Garand, and certainly in the 1950s, had we gone to World War, those would have been used again. So it made sense. It made logical sense that the United States would develop and adopt a successor Garand pattern rifle. As it turned out, the M14 is an excellent weapon, still in some use today as a DMR, and it's been used as a few other things. But it was not the resounding success that they hoped. And the reason for that was the appearance of the AK, of different types in Vietnam, the Chinese type, and I'm sure some Soviet ones. The appearance of the AK basically altered what the infantry fighting was how it was conducted. And therefore, we came up with our own version of a rifle that could deliver the type of capabilities there were, and that was the AR rifle. You know, the AR started out with the AR-10 in 7.62 NATO, very, very promising, adopted in some small numbers, but when it was taken and redeveloped into an intermediate cartridge, small bore, high velocity weapon, then it has literally set the world on fire, and steadily through the nearly 60 years it's been out there, it has slowly become a dominant rifle everywhere. And it's the rifle that, frankly, most people want. And if they have a choice to use that or something else, they tend to use the AR-style rifle. So we did not adopt it. The FNFAL, we did not adopt the FAL rifle because it just was too different, offered no real increase in capability over the M14, and it did not have the advantages, the training advantages that the M14 offered. In retrospect, had we adopted it, I think it would have come to the same fate. We would have decided we needed something lighter. The AR was not going to, the AR was not going to stop. The development on that would not have stopped simply because the FAL was adopted. And the AR was coming, and that's the way that was. The only thing that might have stopped the AR is if the AR had actually been adopted by the U.S. Army, the AR-10, that is. AR-10 is adopted, maybe its characteristics, its lightweight, might have delayed because of there would not have been the perceived need to go to the intermediate cartridge. Now, a lot of people would have wanted to hang on to 7.62 NATO. So had that been adopted, there might have been a change in history. Had the FAL been adopted, history would have played out the same way. Other than replacing the M14, the M16 would have replaced the FAL. Simple as that. As simple as that. Our next question is, what do you think of the HMG Hill & Mack Gunworks STG-44 project? This is the project that essentially they announced, I think, in 2015 or 2016. They were going to turn out a semi-automatic version of the German STG-44 MP44 for basically domestic sporting use. They were going to introduce it in a variety of calibers, the original 8mm Kurtz, 300 Blackout, I think 5.56, and also 7.62x39. That alone would have been an amazing engineering project to introduce what is essentially a new design gun, because it had to be redesigned so much because of the select fire capability of the original STG. So it would have been a daunting task. They've never come through. It's always kind of a manana, give us the $2,000, which I think was their price point, was right around $2,000. Anybody with any sense would know that this is not going to happen. And it wasn't possible. I mean, first of all, there are no STG. There's no large variety or large quantity of STG's parts kits that they could even harvest for parts. So they were going to do things like use the HK91 pattern, G3 pattern trigger pack for these things. It looks sort of like the STG one, enough that to fool you at 10 yards probably, but up close it does not look like the original STG. They've also have had to tweak the design to make this well. And this got hyped. I think it was Forgotten Weapons and InRange TV. Maybe it was just InRange TV basically went and hyped this. And that's always a mistake. These guys like Hudson Engineering, like HMG, and it goes on and on. There's a whole list of these companies that they make a big splash and they get respected people to hype their product, and they get checks from everybody. I'm going to pre-order. I'm going to have one. And frankly, it just doesn't show. And this has happened in the gun industry over the years. It happens probably every 4 or 5 years. Somebody has this, and it never occurs. And I would be very surprised if a single one gets out. Another company tried it, even I think it was 9 or 10 years ago. And the fact of the matter is, they never got beyond prototype stage. I mean, they got some prototypes out that worked, but capitalizing a gun company is a big deal. It's very manufacturer, very equipment intensive, raw materials, supply chain, quality control, all of these things. You just can't start them from scratch. That's why it's much more effective when DSA decided, DS Arms, the FAL guys, they also do AR-15s also, when they decided to get some Israeli parts kits and put them on their existing receiver and turn out an Israeli pattern rifle, hey, they already had everything they needed, and any parts they were short, they could manufacture. They already had assembly lines. They were already making receivers. So it was kind of a much easier task for them to do it. And they're only doing it in a single caliber. You know, it's the 7.62 by 51 NATO. Basically, and it's known engineering. The FAL was made for years and years by FN. It was made in South America. It was made in other places. And it was made in the inch pattern by the British Commonwealth, several countries there. So it's very much a known quantity. They really haven't made STGs since the end of the Second World War, and that's getting to be 70 some years ago now. That's just not, there's not a lot of drawings, there's not a lot of experience, even though theoretically it should be kind of easy to make it because it was an easy to make rifle with stampings and the rest of it. There's a lot of nuances that go into that. And getting it out in 8mm was going to be difficult enough, but trying to adapt it to other calibers was just going to be impossible. And I really question the wisdom of that. I mean, who really wants one in 300 blackout? I mean, to me, the magic of having one is you have as historic a replica as possible. And that's really nice. And that's where Brownells really hit the mark with their retro ARs. They basically brought out what they were like. The furniture isn't quite as good, but other than that, though, the rifles seem to measure up and seem to be every bit as good as the originals. But that's a very, very well-known design. Those are also parts that they can, there's dozens of manufacturers making those. Everything for the STG would have to be made in-house or contracted out specially, and I think that there's nobody currently making any of that. It would be a complete startup, no matter what you want. Anything simple from the magazine latch to the magazines themselves actually would have to be fabricated from scratch, designed, tweaked, made sure they work. It's a big deal. It's like introducing, it really is like introducing four new rifles onto the market that where people would expect, because of the price point, that they would get absolute reliability and durability. It's just too hard a hill to climb. Frankly, I took the easy way out. I bought an ATI STG 44 in 22 long rifle, and frankly, I really like it. I mean, it scratches the itch. It looks good. It looks good on a gun rack. Looks like you have something there. The only real tip off is if you look at the magazine, you can see where it's got a little tab and a slot that pulls down, so you can load the 22 long rifles into it. But if you look at it from the other side, boy, I tell you what, it is really close. It is really close, but it's not an STG. The internals of the thing look basically like an AR conversion kit for 22 long rifle. So it's kind of this blend of a probably, excuse me, airsoft technology plus 22 long rifle kind of conversion kit type technology. And it all comes together and makes a very fun gun. I mean, we show it to people, their initial impression is it's the wow. And then they kind of realize a little bit later, that once they fire it, it kind of just puff, puff, rather than having the recoil of a military rifle, which you kind of expect. So it's definitely an interesting fun gun. If a company really wanted to do something, they could kind of design that to maybe take a 32 ACP or some kind of a blowback cartridge, maybe make it a blowback 9mm, I don't know. You might be able to engineer something like that into an easy to make lower price point gun that would look like an STG and fire at least some manner of center fire cartridge. But to really design the gas-operated kind of higher pressure cartridge, even intermediate cartridges, it's just not going to happen. And when they do get them out to market, if they ever got them out to market, which I doubt, but if they did, I think you would see probably a lot of reliability problems, and it would take a while if they could even stay in business long enough to do it, it would take a while to iron the bugs out. And frankly, you know, who needs a problem like that? It's, you're competing for a lot of money. $2,000 is a lot of price point. That's a lot of price. That's a lot of money. And there's a lot of other guns that are out there that people can get for less money that might be just as satisfying. So that's what I think of the Hill & Mack Gunworks. I really think that they bit off more than they can chew. They're probably well-intentioned, but you know, you can go down the list. There was Dornhaus & Dixon. There was AMT. There's been LAR Grizzly, and there's been just all these, Hudson Manufacturing. All these people think they're bringing something very unique that's going to light the world on fire, and it just doesn't do it. Brownells was very successful with their line of retro ARs. They really aren't and were not a gun manufacturer, but they were a large enough company. They have a lot of firearms experience, and they were able to make those retro ARs. They knew who to go to. They knew what parts to buy. They knew what configuration to put them in, and they did their research, and they did not make a lot of mistakes, and they've come out with great rifles, and a lot of people have discovered just how good the early pattern AR rifles were, that in many ways, outside of sights and a few things, you know, the early pattern rifles really had it right, and they were decades ahead of their time. So that's the answer to that. All right, another question is, where do I think assault rifles will go? And I think that means military rifles. What will the next generation military rifle look like? Here's what I think it's going to look like. I think it is going to be advanced technology, and I think you can look at it in the broader aspect of gun technology, starting with the 19th century. The 19th century was all about mechanical energy. It was about springs and cams and levers, a double action revolver, basically a 19th century design. And look at all the springs and levers and all the parts that have to work in unison in a special way to rotate the cylinder, make the chamber line up, release the hammer, all of that. And it's all done kind of through the trigger mechanism. And essentially, a lot of rifles were the same way. The lever-action rifle, a lot of cams and springs and parts moving in different directions, essentially manually operated, using the double-action revolver, using your about 12, 13 pounds of finger energy, and in a lever-action rifle, pushing the lever forward and bringing it back. The bolt-action rifle was simplified, but it still is the same kind of thing. You have, you know, circular surfaces working and locking the into the chamber, locking the bolt into the chamber, and all of this, a spring in the magazine pushing it up. You know, so it's again, it's springs, it's cams, it's machined surfaces working against each other or on each other. So that's the 19th century. 20th century, we basically had chemical energy. We figured out how to make semi-automatic, full automatic weapons. And we basically use the energy contained in the powder charge of the cartridge to operate the weapons. And we did that from everything from pistols, even the most pedestrian small 32 ACP pistols, to the kind of larger anti-aircraft guns. We figured out how to make that work. The downside of that is you get a lot of residue in there, and you got to clean these things out. And there's, you know, you can fire them long enough, and they will gunk up. So, you know, we're using chemical energy to do that. What's the next step we're going to take? I think it's going to be electronics, and it'll be electrical energy, and it'll be clean, not so much clean in the environmental sense, but it'll be clean insofar as producing residue. I think you'll see a rifle, and if you could imagine an AR rifle where there's no springs in it at all, the trigger is electronic. and you don't have the, it improves marksmanship because you don't pull a shot because you're jerking a trigger or something else. It'll be a very, very crisp, very, very easy motion to actuate a cartridge. The bolt will move back electromagnetically, so it won't need the powder charge of the cartridge to push it back and a spring to propel it forward. You'll have an internal battery. It'll be electromagnetic, and it'll pull the bolt back, and it'll slam it forward without it will do that even without a cartridge in there, without a cartridge being actuated. You will have an electrically moved bolt carrier, and what that will do is that will make it much more reliable. It will absolutely be able to compensate for if there's any residue in the chamber. It'll be able to compensate for things like humidity or the lack of lubrication. May even be self-lubricating, you know, may not need lubrication at all if it's electromagnetic and they design it the correct way. The next thing will be going from the action, which will be electrically operated, electronically controlled. It'll be going up to a sight, and there'll probably be basically a sight that'll be a combination optical sight and thermal sight, and it will have sensors on the outside where it can see the ambient light, so it'll be optical during the day and maybe thermal at night, and in the areas in between it'll be a combination of the two, so you can acquire targets at dawn and dusk. I mean, you know, some of this technology is very nascent and out there, and it's just a question of developing it, ruggedizing it, and it's a question of battery power. Maybe the magazines we have will have a built-in battery, so your ammunition will come in 30 or 40 or 50 round magazines, and when you plug them into the rifle, there is a battery that helps recharge the system of the rifle. Maybe there's sensors on top of the weapon sight that it can gather sunlight and store it. There are some sights like that now. There's those hollow sun sights that kind of do that in a very, very, what would be a primitive way compared to what I'm speaking about. You would also, maybe the arms room rack where your rifle is stowed has got a little charger, and in the buttstock there is a deep cycle long life battery that gets a continuous tiny charge when it's sitting in the arms room. And it also gets that when it's sitting in, you know, your striker vehicle or your armored personnel carrier, your Bradley or your tank. You know, maybe it's the same thing, even your helicopter. Maybe there's a way you just put it when you're being transported. There's always going to be a way that there's probably going to be three or four different ways that energy gets into your weapon and keeps it topped off to make it run. It's that's where weapons will probably go. That's where they will go. Now, the other side of that is that's going to take years and years, and the manufacturing effort, once those even exist, the manufacturing effort to displace all the weapons that are out now is going to be immense. Because even now, you know, you look at Venezuela, and it was a year or two ago, they were handing out, you know, rifles to their, you know, peasant militia. And they were World War II Mauser type rifles, you know, probably maybe post-war ones bought from FN. But, you know, they're handing out 7mm Mauser rifles. I mean, this is 70, 80, maybe 100-year-old technology that they're handing out. And even with the proliferation of AKs and ARs and all these other things, we still haven't displaced all the World War II weapons that are out there. We just haven't. Now they're getting smaller and there's fewer and fewer of them, but they're still out there. I'm sure that if you go to the front lines in the Ukraine, you're going to find PPSHs and probably Mosin snipers and maybe SVT snipers. I'm sure you're going to find somewhere there's these things still being used. So that's probably where weapons are going, towards electronics replacing the mechanical portions of them, and also an improved sight, that maybe even a sight that you look down and you basically, like a rangefinder, you put it on a target and maybe it automatically adjusts, kind of like the way kind of cameras do. You know, it automatically adjusts and increases the power of the optic, you know, so you have a 1 to 10 optic which you can use for everything from CQB to DMR work, all on the same rifle, day or night capability. And the first place you'll see these kind of weapons will be in the Tier 1 special operations of superpower or regional power countries, and then they'll gradually proliferate. I don't expect to see it in my lifetime. I think it could take 50 years, maybe 75 years from now for that to completely happen, but it's technology's out there. Remember a few years ago they had Taya Kyle, the widow of Chris Kyle, the American sniper. I think she won. It was kind of a publicity thing where she had one of these rifles that had some kind of very fancy electronic, you know, range compensating scope on it, and she outshot a guy who was a, you know, some sort of military sniper. I don't know if it was a SEAL or whatever. It was probably just a publicity stunt. But what it shows is that they're making an effort, and there's a realization in people's minds that there are some things you can do that can increase hit probability, and one of them is applying 6 to 12 pounds on a trigger on a rifle that may only weigh 7 or 8 pounds. I don't know how much, you know, a fully auto, you know, depending on an M4, what they have stacked on it. It's basically a 6.5 pound rifle, and then they add things onto it. But if you put 6 pounds of trigger pull on a 6 pound rifle, you can very much throw it off target, and they want to eliminate that as much as they can. And so electronic triggers, which they've kind of tried, maybe even caseless ammo, although I think the technology for that is probably farther away than some of this other, just simply the durability of military ammunition. You'll see it in civilian, perhaps in civilian use before you see it in military use, just because of the brutal environment a lot of military ammunition has to survive in, or is designed to survive in. But you know, we'll see that it will come, and that's what will displace the AR. You know, the AR is ruling the world right now, but it won't rule the world forever. There will be something else. My deal is, this century is the electronic century. Started in the 1990s, when the chemical power century started in the 1890s, and really kind of some of the mechanical springs and manufacturing, all that started in the very early 1800s, maybe even the 1790s. So probably by the 2090s, we'll have definitely see the next. But anyway, that's my musing, and this is all for our podcast. Thank you for listening, and I hope you follow it. And until next time, this is Old School Guns out.